Hi, it's Joel, your host here. In this very special three-part mini-series, we focus on the stories of three people all from the same family and how different autoimmune diseases have significantly impacted their lives. All from the United States, you will hear from Kevin Gibbons, who has relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, his partner Lauren Gibbons, who lives with ulcerative colitis, and Kevin's brother Matthew, who has been diagnosed with Crohn's disease. At the time of recording, we didn't plan to tell this story as one, and as such, each episode can be listened to in isolation or out of order should you wish. But as this family, one by one, stepped forward and came onto the show to share their lived experiences, it touched me on a level that even after years of being privileged enough to have a front row seat with people sharing their most personal stories, still moved me, much to my surprise. Coming from a family with a history of multiple autoimmune diseases myself, their shared experiences resonated with me and how I, as a big brother, share the pain and feelings of helplessness with my siblings who live with other inflammatory conditions. I wanted to draw the listener's attention to the fact that these are three people in one family enduring so much at such young ages. I felt I owed it to them who, for the majority, were bravely telling their story publicly for the first time, to do their stories justice and give them the platform they deserve. If you enjoy these episodes, please do subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen, and thank you for listening. So I'm delighted to bring in tonight, guys, somebody that has been a sort of like real shining light in our Twitch community over the last couple of months. Mostly, I think, dragged there by their other half, but we'll get into that and find out. But I think this is really special for me because we create our peer support community over on Twitch. We use gaming for an escapism, and we do that, you know, to build community. But this is the first time that out of that, we've had a guest come on the Chronic Pain Club talk show live. So without further ado, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome in Kevin Gibbons. Kevin, with magic, you should be there. How are you?
Doing well. How about you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm good. This is the first time I've heard your voice, which is a little bit weird. Because obviously you watch me all the time, but I only sort of get text chat. So so hopefully you're the more comfortable one in this conversation. You should feel like that. I don't know what time of the day is it where you are. Thank you for joining us on your Sunday.
It's not quite super early. It's about 11 o'clock, so it's not quite super hot yet either. It's nice.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I feel less guilty about it. We've had people join us on here and they've sort of like just randomly dropped in. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I feel really guilty. So first of all, Kevin, do you want to just sort of introduce yourself? Let us know where you are in the world. You know,
of course,
and then we'll get stuck in.
So my name is Kevin Gibbons. I'm a decision support analyst at a small community center hospital in rural Washington in the lower Yakima Valley. It's a lot of numbers, a lot of numbers in reporting, but they're important numbers. So it's decision support. They're important.
Yeah, brilliant. No, as somebody who's got a career in IT and I always sort of try to justify it without it sounding sort of geeky, it's very important. So yeah, thank you for giving up your Sunday. I really appreciate it. And yeah, this one's really interesting for me because this, I think you're a part of our community and I had no idea. Like a lot of the time we've got people in our community that we sort of share quite a lot. And by all means, guys, continue to share your story in chat as we go along. And we sort of get quite familiar with their challenges and everything else. And then it sort of like came up that you were living with multiple sclerosis and that kind of wasn't on my radar. So yeah, do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about, well, maybe first of all, what multiple sclerosis is, because this is the first time we've covered it on the show. And then we'll get stuck into your sort of diagnosis journey.
Sure. I'm certainly no expert, but I'll do my best.
You're a lived experience expert. That's good enough for us here.
Exactly. I learned a lot from physicians. So multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune demyelinating disease where your immune system attacks your nerves in a way that instead of attacking the nerve endings, it attacks the myelin sheath, which is sort of like an insulator. Imagine an extension cord, how it's got plastic or rubber on the outside so that the electrical signal doesn't, you know, short out. Nerves work kind of the same way. And what's happened to mine in my case is that insulator has been destroyed by my immune system and the signals don't travel properly. So yeah, it doesn't jump. They don't jump to other nerves, I think, but they'll just stop working, essentially.
Okay, and then how does that kind of present for sort of the average? I appreciate you can only talk on your own experience, but how does that sort of present that damage?
Well, for me, I started, the first thing I noticed when it all, and I guess kind of how it started, was tingling in my neck during final season at university. And we didn't really know what it was, so we kind of just wrote it off and let it go. That's all it was. And then a year later, final season again, next year, I got eye pain. And when I say eye pain, it was optic nerve pain, because it was it's behind my eye. It's like a headache almost, or a migraine. And I had a blind spot in my peripheral vision, which was new.
Must have been terrifying.
It was, because I just woke up one day, my eye hurt, and I had a blind spot. I was like, this is bad, whatever this is. And we can get into that more. Moving on to when I had the thing that really put me in the hospital, I had the entire right side of my body was numb, head to toe. Like, face wasn't drooping, but my face was numb. I couldn't feel, there was no sense of physical touch on the right side of my body. I had no fine motor skills in the right side of my body only. I couldn't hear properly. Like, I went tone deaf in my right ear, right, but only my right ear, which was very strange. So there were a slew of symptoms that came about that I had no experience with, and I had no idea what to do. And I would call, you know, my family, be like, hey, what should I do? And they would kind of panic and freak out. You're having an episode of some sort. And I was okay.
It sounded like you were the more chilled one in all this. I think I was climbing the wall.
I wasn't dead. That's how I thought of it. I was like, this feels like everything I've read about what happens in a stroke is this, and then you're dead in 2 hours. And I woke up with it. So I figured if I had a stroke at night, I would have not woken up.
Yeah.
Or a seizure or something. I wouldn't have woken up from it. So I wasn't.
So what age was this? Because it sounds like you must be quite young. Like,
yes, so this all started I guess I was about 17.
Oh, that's wow.
That's when the neck pain started. That's when that started. I was 17 or 18. I really do think it was 17 though. And then, like I said, it took a couple years for it to really evolve into something that made me go, oh, I have to address this in a more immediate fashion.
Yeah. And I, as somebody who played contact sport, and I understand you did as well, I imagine that must have been so easy just to put that down to your sort of hobbies as well.
I don't know. I don't know if playing American football has turned my brain into mush.
No, what I mean is, sorry, I wasn't clear. At the time, you get a pain or an ache or a tingling or the amount of sensations and things, I would just automatically put down to...
You're almost taught, be tough, because it's not going to be a big deal. Yeah. You'll get better.
Because you've got this sort of, you do contact sports, I think the amount of things I dismissed anyway, because I just thought, because I do that thing, I don't know, that's what I was getting at, sorry, I wasn't clear. If you had sort of similar sort of thoughts.
No, all of my injuries are, because it didn't really affect me when I was playing sports. I didn't play sports in college. I kind of stopped being athletic after high school, which is when the MS started becoming a situation anyway. So the football would have been bad if I had continued it, I think. Worse, I should say. I don't think that it was good for the condition. But I think that if I'd continued doing a contact sport or really any physical activity that was strenuous, in that sort of fashion, it probably would have exacerbated the condition itself.
Carry on.
I do think I kind of dodged a bullet in not continuing with sports.
But yeah, really, if there had been an overlap there, I suppose you could add a lot more on your plate, it's a common theme that comes up in the conversations on here, where sort of like, if you're diagnosed, everything gets attributed to that condition. And if you're not diagnosed, so many people go through those gates where they just put it down to something else and something else. And you know, I know that when I look at my sort of diagnosis journey, you think, well, I could have got that looked at maybe earlier. So with yours, obviously it escalated to a point where you clearly couldn't ignore it anymore and you can't feel it all down one side. And so then what did that sort of next step look like for you? I'm guessing that was a trip to the ER and then things went from
there. It was two trips to the ER, unfortunately. Right, okay. 'Cause the first one in this, I know that we go on this show not to bash providers, not to bash hospitals, but I don't have a good experience with this one. We went in. Yeah. I mean, it's what happened. We went in. I had my brother. I had my fiance at the time, and I had my brother's partner with us because we were kind of panicking. So they drove me to the ER because I couldn't really drive, shouldn't be driving rather. And we got there, we waited, we got to the ER. And like I said, it was practically stroke symptoms. Mm-hmm. Like any reasonable ER physician would have said, oh, this is a stroke. You got to fast track a CT. Because, I mean, that's what I would have done. I work in a hospital, so I kind of understand the... I understand how the emergency department works a little bit. And they didn't. Just nothing. I got a once over, and the ER physician was like, I don't see anything wrong with you. I think you should just go home. And I was like, well, what should I do about the numbness? Oh, it might get better.
And they've done all the usual tests, which confirms the numbness is sort of like there, because I've had several of those tests where, like, you know, sometimes they'll stab you and you feel something. Sometimes they do and you don't. And they've done all of that sort of stuff and still.
No, she did. Yeah, she didn't do much of anything. I don't know. Yeah, it was very strange. So then I went home and I was like, okay, let's see if it gets better, because what else are we going to do? And then the next day it wasn't better. And I think we waited another day after that, because I had, at the time, I was a delivery boy for Jimmy John's on a bicycle in uptown New Orleans. And I was like, okay, well, I got to go to work. So I rode a bicycle.
I'm only laughing because obviously in the past, I hope that's not offensive. Yeah,
don't do that again. No.
Not of you riding a bike when you can't feel them. Sorry.
I had enough balance, but I did. I went to work. I kind of showed up and said, hey, I'm not doing so great, and showed them my hand not quite working, and they were like, okay, you can stay for an hour, but you really got to go. Yes. So I left, and then it was actually April Fool's Day. Rent was due, so I had to go drop off my rent. So I drove to the landlord's office to drop off rent, and then I got home and I was like, okay, this isn't better. I really shouldn't be doing any of the things that I've been doing, and I probably need to go back to the hospital. And that's when we went back to the hospital. And they, at the second hospital, because we went to a different one, mm-hmm. we went to the ER, they did a once over, and they did do all of the numbness tests and fine motor skills tests and stuff. And he said, hey, man, we got to take some images, because I don't know what this is. I can't tell what it is. And it could be, you could have a lot of things going on right now, and we don't know what they could be. Okay, that sounds fine. So we wait a little while. We do the imaging, which was it's an MRI study of your brain. You do one with contrast, one without. So it was about 2 hours in a tube, which I'm used to at this point now. And then you got to wait for that to get read. So I was sitting in the waiting bay, I guess you could call it, for about half an hour. And then they call me back to the room, and he sits me down and he looks at his images and he says, okay, this is going to be shocking, but I think you're okay. You've got 10 lesions on your brain and central nervous system. So that wasn't shocking at all. I was like, okay, what does that mean? And wow. He said, I don't know, they're lesions. So we have to do some testing. And then I think from there, I was wheeled to the neuro ICU. I can't really remember that part.
I can imagine more your memory of that. I'm trying to process that might be a little bit sketchy. I think don't beat yourself up too much.
Right.
That's a lot to take on.
The whole immediate diagnosis and then the next like 6 hours, I can't remember because I was in shock.
And it's quite rare as well, like for an autoimmune disease. Like we hear so many people on here that get this really long, drawn out, like 7 years, and bits and pieces of the puzzle come together. So to get that sort of like, I know you didn't have any answers at that point, but to get that sort of really hard, firm evidence of a problem so quickly at that point, that's a lot to process, isn't it?
It was, and it was frustrating at the time because, and this goes back to the optic problem, because when that first presented, we actually tried to chase it down because that was a big deal. So I went to a regular optometrist and they did some retinal scans. It wasn't the retina, of course. So they moved on and he said, I actually think we need to look at a neuro-ophthalmologist, which is neuro-ophthalmology. It specializes in the optic nerve. Great. We have one of those in New Orleans. Great. This works out great. So I go down, we do a test. She does her exams and says, okay, I think we should order MRI. This was a year before I went to the hospital. The orders never came through for some reason. I don't know what happened. I don't know. And at the time I didn't know, oh, I can just call scheduling and have this all sorted. I didn't know that. I never got a call back. I went at one point after a few months to look up the practicing physician again, and I couldn't find her in the network. So I'm not sure if there was turnover at the hospital or what, but it just kind of fell through the cracks and never got addressed. And then it got worse. So that's how I ended up in the hospital for a week.
But there was clearly opportunities there, wasn't there, to stop it? Yes. At that point where you're then faced with that news of you've got 10 lesions on your brain and we don't know what they are like that. I can't even imagine. It must have felt like you just dropped off a cliff at that point.
It was, yeah, that's a good way to put it, actually, because I was not okay. even when I did get the test results back and they were like, hey, it's MS, it didn't make it better. It wasn't like, oh, great.
Imagine they kind of present it as a positive, bearing in mind what it could have been, but still, right, that's like, you know, it's a chronic life-changing condition.
Yeah, it was, and I still couldn't, it's not like I was better. They told me, it was like, okay, now you've still got months of PT.
Did you get any sort of like mental health support? I know what the answer is here, but was there any sort of mental health support at that moment in time, or is it literally here you go and you're waiting in a corridor or on a bed trying to process that?
Pretty much just sitting there thinking. Yeah. Said, hey, here's what you got. You got to go wait for us to figure out what to do next. And then you sit there in a dark room. It was like, this is intense. I probably could have asked them to turn the lights on, but I didn't want to. I was more comfortable in the dark space because it was in a dark place. So it worked out.
I couldn't even, you know, I say, because my experience has been that dribs, drabs, you're waiting and waiting and waiting and something happens and another little bit happens and another little bit of the puzzle sort of falls in. And we hear that a lot. So to get just that, like that brick wall of like, you know, in the face information, that's really hard to process. And then I suppose what happened next? Like, presumably you couldn't just go home with all the issues that you had.
No, I was admitted, like I said, to the neuro ICU for 5 days, and we were doing 1,000 milligrams of methylprednisone daily through IV, which is like elephant levels. A lot of steroids. So we did a lot of steroids to stop the inflammation as fast as we could, and there was nothing else that they were giving me for treatment at the time because they didn't know. They ran a lot of blood tests, like a lot of blood tests. I think we did 3 days of blood tests. I don't know what they were for.
Probably to see if the elephant dose of steroids.
Sure, it wasn't killing you. Probably. It was intense. But it was a 5-day neuro ICU stay, and then I was discharged, I think, Thursday or Friday. It was Friday. Before I was discharged, they met with a counselor and we scheduled a neurology appointment for like 10 days later, which was good that even worked out. We started getting the PT worked out because physical therapy was important. We just, as we were in the hospital, we started working on those things because those were the next steps. And then we did about 2 months of physical therapy that was like guided at a clinic. And after that, it was all at home physical therapy for about 2 more months to get sensation back and fine motor skills back. And that luckily worked.
Life changing then. right. Moment in time, especially. So I guess the whole time this is going on, you know, you've got issues of like work and finance and all the other things that come with being laid up for that long. So like, how did that impact you? Because like, I don't know, you watch television, don't you? And people get a diagnosis and then that seems to be like the path to recovery, but people don't appreciate that delay that you have and the disruption that comes during that process of getting to a manageable place, you know, and I'm not assuming you're in a manageable place now, but you know what I mean?
Right, no.
So how did
I don't even know how I got, I just didn't stop. Because the other thing we did is we started medication and there were side effects all at the same time, all during physical therapy, all this stuff. We started the biologic and it had side effects that were debilitating that lasted about a month. So it was all just piling on. And all I could think was, I'm doing all of this stuff to get better and then it will be normal. Right now it sucks and it's going to suck, but it will get better. You're working to make it better and you can see it getting better. You know, that was important, is having, I didn't even track my progress that well. I really didn't, but being able to go from the day to day and see, hey, this is improving and improving and improving. That's what kept me going through all of that, I think, like the most, I should say.
And I'm assuming you had some sort of like support network or something around you in terms of family, friends, or just
family
sort of
and friends. Mostly. I really didn't reach out that much. My wife was incredibly supportive. My parents were incredibly supportive, but I didn't want to burden anyone, so I didn't push. I didn't ask for help. And part of this is saying thank you, because I found this group, or I should say Lauren found this group, and it's been great to get into something, because shared experience is really good. And I didn't even consider it.
Thank you. But somebody that didn't lean on any support groups or charities, like full stop. I've had long-term health conditions since I was 10 years old, and I got to my 30s before ever reaching out. You know, and then things are available, and we spend all day on this show telling people and signposting and stuff like that. There is definitely some personality types or whatever, those of us that we just don't, we'll put our head down, focus on the goal, lean on those around us and crack on, and not know that there is sort of like a bigger support sort of system available, isn't there?
Yeah, and I would say for anyone, if there is anyone watching that is in a situation that they're like, oh, I'm not feeling about it, you should look into support groups, because even if you think that you're a not sociable person, there are other not sociable people in those groups. That's what I've learned. Yeah. You'll bond over that.
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of, like, for anyone who's joining us or is not familiar with this, basically we do stuff over on a platform called Twitch, twitch.tv/JoelVsArthritis. And we use gaming as like a form of escapism. And I think gaming by its kind of nature is a little bit antisociable. You know, like I took a long while before I would turn on the mic on a voice chat or anything when I was a bit younger. And, you know, so I think it softens the blow a little bit, because you've got that common thing that everybody's interested in and you can dip in and out. It's not like this full on, you know. So the first sort of like support stuff, I don't know about you, it sounds like maybe you didn't reach out or have that stuff offered. The first sort of like support things that were offered to me was like sitting in a circle with a load of people that probably weren't relatable to me or different ages and demographics and things. And I was never going to do that, you know? So, I think that's where, like you say, you don't have to be sociable, but you could take from it what you need, can't you?
Yes. And it's important, because like I said, I didn't do it. And having people here that understand, it's fantastic, because you can lean on them if you need to, or they can lean on you. I've come to learn that I like that part more.
And also, do you find it takes some of the weight off like those immediately around you? You know, because like that's one of the things I find is like, rather than me keep going to my wife or keep going to my family or whatever, if you've got a support like system like that, it kind of, you mentioned burden earlier, which is a word that comes up on this show a hell of a lot. Do you find that helps with that, or the way that you feel about that?
I think it helps, yes, because I don't have to, because I can go somewhere that not everyone is a part of in my circle, which is fine. I don't need everyone in a circle in my spaces. Yeah. But I can go somewhere that doesn't involve them, so that I don't feel like I'm putting it on them, which is, that's also great. I haven't, like I said, I haven't really leaned on this particular community because I haven't had to, but the fact that it's there does make me feel better.
I absolutely love that we have some people in here with us, both on this channel and over on Twitch, and that have no, they don't need nothing in return, but they still show up. You know, we've got people that don't have any condition or lived experience or aren't a caregiver for someone, and I absolutely love that. So yeah, thank you for being a part of it, because it's easy to understand why people would come when they're looking for help, but to be here and be present and support other people when you don't need it, that says a lot about you.
I don't know. It's a fantastic community as well. It's not just the support that's important to me. I like that all of these people are nice.
And I think as well, you get to a certain point as well where it kind of like it takes a form, and then it sort of like attracts that similar type, doesn't it, or character or whatever, and the people that aren't don't stick, and the ones that are do. And I think that's the beauty of it. And what I would say, guys, if you try out any of these things, or you know, if you come over to our Twitch community or our Discord and it just is not your vibe, that's fine. There will be others that are, and we've said that a lot when we're on live streams, where it's just like, you know, if that's the thing you're looking for, then that's not what we do, then that's cool, just, you know, but go find it somewhere else. Doesn't have to be, you know, like a single source, does it? And I think anyone was around last Saturday for the AI arthritis live stream probably saw that there was like different angles everybody can take. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to your condition because I'm really keen to understand more about it. Is that okay? So obviously you went through that horrible period. At what point did it feel like you had it under control, if you ever have felt like you've had it under control? And I'm just trying to understand, like, you know, how have you come from where you were back then to where you are today, and like you're employed and you're sitting here in front of me, and you know, and we're talking, and presumably you've not got too much going on, you know, but how did you get from there to here? I'm just interested to, you know, for other people sort of like who might be in that place that you were.
Yeah, of course. And it's kind of an interesting story. It's not just, oh, I just got better, you know, because it certainly wasn't that simple. It was not that simple. It's interesting. It's a lot interesting, actually, because the physical symptoms that I had went away in about 3 months. I started Tecfidera or dimethyl fumarate, which is a twice daily biologic pill, which is nice. It's nice that it's a pill, not injectable, all that stuff. But it caused pretty intense abdominal cramping, pain. I'd be doubled over for like 15 minutes at a time, trying not to faint. it was bad. But that got better. And once that got better, I was like, okay, so the medicine's doing what it's supposed to. My immune system has been modulated or whatever it's supposed to do. The physical symptoms got better for the most part. At this point, they've pretty much come back. But for a while, I still had some numbness and a little bit of loss of fine motor skills. Playing video games actually did help my hand get better. Okay. So there was some therapy in video games for that situation. How did we get there? So we had to leave New Orleans because I couldn't find work there. So we got an opportunity in Washington and took it and just took off. We got the dog in New Orleans, of course. That's actually when I started feeling better. I decided, because my wife wanted a dog. Yeah. And I was like, I don't know, I'm very sick right now. And then I got better and it was like, well, I could probably have a dog. And then the dog was crazy for a while, but that worked.
I can relate to having a crazy dog.
Yeah. The dog has helped a lot with, the dog has helped a lot more than I was willing to admit, actually. That it's very therapeutic, I realized, to have an animal there to help. She's actually been probably more of a rock than some people in my family, which maybe isn't good, but it works for me.
I can totally relate. As somebody who, until I lost my last dog, I didn't realize what a hole that was filling. Just that dependability and that always someone always wanted to see you, and right. that constant. And also for me, it got me out of the house and got me moving. And
exactly.
Can totally relate.
Right. So the dog was good. We moved about 6 months after we got the dog, I think. Maybe. No, it was about a year. So we moved to Washington. I thought everything was under control. It was going well, sort of. And then it wasn't, as it turns out. So one of the lesions on my brain is on my amygdala, which, as some of us know, is what controls emotion, hunger, etc. So going into 2021, I want to say, no, 2020, going into 2020, I was facing some depression that I was like, okay, we could probably handle this with therapy and, you know, other holistic approaches. And the therapy did help. We did cognitive behavioral therapy, which was effective for a while. For the depression, but it evolved into bipolar depression because I guess that's just what it did. And that led to a rough patch in the summer. But we got that medicated, actually, and that helped a lot. And I'd say that after that medication started taking effect, I actually felt like myself again for the first time in maybe 3 years. So.
Oh, yeah, my heart goes out to you for someone. Well, you know, you've watched me talk long enough to know my experiences and how relatable that side of it is. And it's not talked about, is it? You know, especially with stuff like MS being as sort of like physically debilitating as it can be, people forget about that side of it and how it changes you. And over time, it changes you and sometimes sort of like it always feels like a permanent way. And like you say about your depression changed and everything. So yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm also glad that you've worked through that. And so like, where would you say you are like today in terms of, you know, you've got, I, maybe do you want to explain before we answer that question about sort of how multiple sclerosis progresses? Because yours is the relapse and remittent type, isn't it? There is another type which I can't remember. That's the one that just doesn't go away, does it?
Right. It's, I can't remember. It's progressive. There's another word in there. It starts with progressive, and then there's another word, multiple.
Sorry, folks, this is on me. I should have done my homework.
I probably should have too.
It's totally on me. But so presumably from the type that you have, that it flares almost. I don't know if you use the term flare with MS like we would, but yeah, okay, yeah. So it flares and goes away. So all right, let's start there then. How what is that like to live with, not knowing when, like, you know, what next month is going to be, or how long the current situation is going to last, etc.
I like to analogize it as there's a giant monster behind you that kind of wants to kill you, but doesn't feel like doing it yet. And it's because that's what it is. That's what you've got. You've got this thing looming over you that, you know, okay, I've got guidelines to keep this from getting worse, but it's going to get me again. Like, it, there's no doubt that's what's going to happen. I just don't know when. And it's hard to get used to. That was probably one of the things that drove me into depression. I was like, I don't know what I can and can't do effectively. I don't know. I can't go outside if it's too hot. I can't go outside if it's too hot, for example. I can't overexert myself. I need to stay hydrated. I have to avoid certain foods, all the things. So that was scary.
And it goes back to that kind of like grieving yesterday, fear and tomorrow thing as well, isn't it? Like, do you struggle like I do to like live in the present when you've got that monster on your shoulder kind of thing? Because like, even if you're having a good day, I imagine that's still in your mind at point through that day.
It does. It's there all the time. It is there all the time. I've come to learn that it's there all the time and there's nothing you can do. And that has helped. You know, I can't control it, so why would I worry about it so much? There's nothing that I can do except wait. So that's what I do, and I try not to let it bother me. And that sounds easier said than done. It took me years to get to the point where I am today with it. It took me until about now, actually. It really is it's a process of understanding what you're capable of, what the disease is capable of, and how okay are you with it?
Yeah, it's rough. And people totally underestimate that. You know, if your condition is pain related, they focus on the pain, and yours in terms of like, if it's like a disability thing, they focus on that. They don't focus on the effect it has on you living with it and living with that uncertainty. And what does your sort of cycle look like? You know, like, how long are those flares or periods of remission? And, you know, and I'm just trying to get a flavor of what that's like to live with, you know, or is it really random?
It is. I think, I don't know. I've only been diagnosed for 4 years, and I haven't had another major flare, which is great. I attribute it to the medication that I'm on. Yeah. But I do have minor ones. For example, I'll get like I get ear pain, like in my ear canal. It's kind of like the eye pain. I get eye and ear pain that lasts for about a week. Sometimes the optic neuritis gets bad enough that I can't look at screens because it hurts. And it's like, well, I can't go to work today. And that's not good because it makes you not, you don't even feel sick. You just can't look at stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't work today. I'm useless. And it's for no reason other than my eye kind of hurts, or I don't want to make this worse because it gets worse, because I have tried to push through it and it just gets worse. So the best thing to do is relax, take it easy and keep it from getting worse, but at what expense?
And then on top of that, you've got the mental side, haven't you? So even if the condition is fairly well controlled, that depression side doesn't just matter. I get so tired trying to explain this to people, but it doesn't just like magically, just because your body's well, it doesn't necessarily mean the mind is well and vice versa. And so you feel like you're sort of fighting on two fronts, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. And having it under control certainly helps. But when it gets bad, it's hard not to fall into it. It's hard not to fall into it. That's actually one of the things that I struggled with the most with my mental health, was spiraling into it. Cause I would totally play into it. I'd say, okay, let's just let it go and see what my mind comes up with. Cause I'm curious as to what I can think of. And it's unhealthy. Don't do that. if you're listening, because it's you can spiral out of control. And
it's a lot easier to go with the tide than to fight it as well, with that sort of my personal experience again here. And that's the hard thing. You have to be so conscious of it to see the warning signs and to kick back out of that. And like I say, sometimes you can then get better. But I don't know about you, I always have a bit of a lag. So, like, you know, physically I'll get good, but then it's almost like you've got to process all the stuff you missed out on, all the stuff you had to cancel, all the stuff you might have lost. So you always have that sort of like delay, don't you? So let's say you're not just like magically clicking back in mentally okay.
That last stage is one of the most difficult, I think, because you are better and you're doing again, but you don't want to.
Yeah.
And any of it too. It's like, I'm glad that I can do all these things that I'm doing again, but I forgot that I didn't like doing them. Or I don't want to right now because I should be doing the things that I just missed out on, or I should be going above and beyond, even doing things that for me, you know, that make me happy. But you know, reality sets in and you have to do what you have to do.
Yeah, that bit in particular, we haven't covered that on the show, and it's really important because I do that. Like, I've started like adding on a couple of days, like a buffer, you know, because I always feel like I almost like have to like make up, do stuff for me, do something for me, you know, the well-being kind of thing. I literally done it just recently where physically I was good, but because like you say, you missed out on stuff, or you realize there's that daily life that you have to go back to after you've been sick can be a little bit overwhelming. And I'm always having to put like a little buffer in. So that's a really good, point. I probably didn't realize why I was doing it, just that I did it. So thank you for opening my eyes to that one. And in terms of your condition, like what is the outlook with your type of multiple sclerosis? Is it progressive? Does the damage sort of layer over time, or is it just, does it go back and you sort of carry on as normal, or is it complete unknown?
I don't think it's I'm actually not sure. Mine, they have graphs. I remember looking at graphs on how they work differently. Progressive does not get better, from what I understand. Relapsing, remitting, you can have a major flare like I did, and it will get better, but maybe not all the way. Mine, in my case, it got mostly better, which is good. I'd say maybe 3%. I've got 97% capability that I did before, which is, I'd say that's close enough to 100 to ground up. But as it gets worse, or as it happens more, the damage does become, it compounds a little bit. I don't know that next time I have a giant flare that I'll come out of it as well. I don't know, frankly. I think damage varies depending on the severity of the flare, and it, depending on that severity, is what determines if it gets better or stays not better.
Yeah. And that's, a lot to live with, isn't it? People undervalue that sort of like the weight of that, and that unknown, and that losing stuff. And I say it's grief. It comes up every time on the show, but is a form of grief, isn't it?
Yeah, I had to stop. This one actually kind of bummed me out. About a year before my diagnosis, I had picked up banjo and was trying to learn how to pick a banjo. And then I got,
as you do.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then I got sick and I had to put it down. And that actually really upset me because I was thoroughly enjoying learning banjo. I haven't really gotten back into it. I was thinking about it last week. I was like, oh, I could pull out the banjo for the interview. Be like, yeah, this is one of the things I used to get better. And then as I broke it. So I haven't played it in a while. So a piece broke. And I was like, well, I guess I won't be doing that.
Again, though, it's another important point to mention. All this stuff behind me was in storage for like 10 years. I couldn't even look at it when I couldn't play anymore. You know, proper made me miserable. And it was almost like, I'm just going to lock away and forget about it. And I went for a process of like, okay, I'll try and find some enjoyment. I can't do it how I used to, but I'll try and find some enjoyment. And now I kind of put it there to almost like remind me that what I did back then was still an achievement, just because I've kind of worked through that process of just feeling miserable of losing it. But that takes so long, and people don't get that how hard, and I still have them like the wobbles where I just want to chuck it all in a skip. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's hard, isn't it? You know, because you get them constant reminders, you know, and even if I was going back to the computer gaming thing, I don't know if you notice, but there'll be some days you just, I cannot do this. Either the brain is not quick enough or the hands don't function. I can't do this. And like, do you find that then sort of it feels like it's like poisoned your hobby as well. Or yes. Is that just me getting very angry at
most? Right, yeah, no, you get it's incredibly frustrating. One of my hobbies is online simulated racing, and that doesn't work when nothing's working. It's hard, and that one is all, like I said, it's online, so you're dealing with other people too. So you know, yeah. it's certainly can feel like it's affecting the parts of your life that you use to enjoy yourself, and that's probably why it was so difficult to lose some of those things. It's because suddenly you can either replace them, which some of us have done, and that's probably a healthy thing to do. But in some cases you can't just replace it. You know, I can sort of play my banjo now, but at the time I couldn't. And I was like, so this might be a thing that I can't do. What should I do instead? And I thought about it for a while and then kind of got to where you were. Yeah, I'll just see what I pick. I'm glad I learned banjo. But no, there is certainly a lot of weight on losing hobbies and or activities that you once enjoyed.
I suppose that kind of brings us back to the stuff that we're doing over on Twitch in terms of like trying to do those things that are like low level, low key, non-competitive, you know, sort of no shouty, yeah. Screamy kind of kids, like taking it to the extremes and stuff like that. And do you find like that stuff helps? Because I know for me, just taking away the high end bit from it. So like, I don't stream the games I play in my free time for that very reason, because I don't need the stress of the bad days. So I found something I could play good or bad day. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, no, I'd say it certainly does help to not have competition sometimes. And for those of us who do in chat know me saying that is crazy because I'm an incredibly competitive person. Okay.
No, we've definitely not got that vibe on Discord at all.
Right, so. No, that's because I keep it separate. No, I certainly do appreciate the non-competitive and the more relaxed stuff nowadays, because I'm certainly not as quick as I once was. So even if I did want to do all of that competitive gaming or anything competitive at this point, it would be difficult for me because I'm not capable anymore to be competitive. And that would certainly bother me. So I just don't do competitive things anymore.
And I've had people in the past say, well, you can't run away from stuff. But I think there's a big difference between like being able to take that sort of like pleasure out of stuff you still enjoy and or just avoiding what's going to be an obvious trigger. Do you know what I mean? So like you can still do stuff. It just maybe doesn't look like the same, you know, it's not at the same level, or you have to sort of change the bar you were setting for yourself previously or whatever.
Right. No, I don't think it's running away from it. And if it is, then sure. But I think it's more like you said, removing yourself from a situation that puts you in a place that you don't want to be. If you know that you're limited, why would you put yourself in a situation where you'll be at a detriment because of that? You know, not to say that if you enjoy doing that, please. But if you're like me and you're incredibly competitive and you want to at least put in a show, you know, or make a name or anything, not just come in last, then you certainly have to be ready to accept that, I think.
And we saw that coming in last firsthand when we used to stream Fall Guys. For anyone that's in chat that used to watch my terrible performances on there, and I quickly realized, we can't have a peer support community where there's any form of competition, because it just doesn't work. You know, there's always going to be someone that comes away from that feeling more miserable. And I think that's why we stumbled upon the Minecraft thing, because it's kind of like you can go off there and do your own thing and just disappear, or you can engage with chat like you talked about on Discord or whatever that might look like and get a bit of peer support or help others. So it kind of is the best of both worlds, isn't it?
I would say so. No, it's, I like what you've created over there.
Well, I still feel like I've got a long way to go, but I'm it's only possible because of people like yourselves coming in and joining and helping other people feel welcome and sharing your experiences. And like I say, coming on shows like this for us to add a bit more context, because we've got so many people in there that are dealing with all sorts of manner of things in their everyday lives. And I cannot tell you, I think you're the second person from the community. We had Amy do it. Amy sort of like broke new ground with that. So I'm very grateful for her being brave enough to do that. And then yourself, I think it really helps put a story and a face behind what we're trying to build, you know. So when somebody has a bad day, we get a little bit of a flavor about why that is. So I'm so grateful for you joining us on here and giving up your time, Kevin, and going through some really like personal things, because it gives a window into why we're doing what we're doing, and why, you know, it might be that people just go in there and they don't talk, but they just have just that feeling surrounded by people that get it. Can help, you know.
It's helped me. Like I said, it has helped me. This community has actually helped me look at the world in a different way, because for a long while for a long while I've looked at everyone kind of like, I don't think that anyone is out for others. And that was kind of that probably came from the depression. It stuck, and I went with it, and I met this group, and I was like, these people are working for others. I mean, of course they're doing their own thing, they have their own lives, they're all their own people, but in this setting they're all here together in just for fun. It's fantastic, for fun, for support, for all the stuff, and they're great people, so thanks.
that just makes my year. It generally does, because like, you know, we've done this for a long while with nobody around, and we'll carry on doing it if that goes back to those days. And just like I say, to get real world voices, faces coming back and saying how it benefits, it really does like fuel us. Because like, we're quite open on Twitch, for example, that for us to go live, we've got Near Cheeks dealing with a puppy and a toddler and a mod job and a cooking dinner and all this sort of thing. And people just think it just magically happens and everything else. So to hear somebody actually getting a benefit from that, just and from somebody in a totally different part of the world as well. Yeah, I really, really appreciate it. And I'd like to point out, guys, Kevin has not been given any questions or anything in advance, hasn't been asked to say this stuff, hasn't been paid to say this stuff.
And I didn't take any notes. So.
and if I wasn't so sunburnt, you'd see I was blushing and genuinely made up from those comments. So, thank you so much, Kevin. I understand that you don't want me to sort of plug or share it or find anyone, but I suppose I can tell people that they can find you over on Discord, maybe on our server.
Yeah, you can always find me in Discord. I think I've got my indicator as offline.
Yeah, no, I'd have to do that regularly for just mental health reasons.
Right, yeah. I think I'm offline, but I'm not always offline. You can find me at, I think it's Gibberama with no caps. That's my Discord. I don't know if I'm really active on other social media a whole lot. Not really.
And I suppose just because I feel like we've covered some real big things there, and this is a really big question to end on, so I'm sorry in advance, because like I say, guys, I don't send these in advance. I try to keep it just informal, two people talking and learning about each other. And, you know, with all of those experiences you've had, either if you went through that again, is there anything you'd do differently? Or if there was somebody going through that now at the start of that journey, is there any sort of like one piece of advice you'd give or anything? I realize that's a big thing to put you on the spot.
No, it's perfectly fine. I'd say the one takeaway that I have from all of that 3-year period of dealing with it is you need to chase down your symptoms. Like, make sure that whatever it may be, because it might be tingling in the neck, it might be ear pain, it might be eye pain, whatever it is, you should find the root cause. That's my takeaway, is because I let things go and just didn't do anything about it. And then even when I had the eye issue and I didn't get the MRI scheduled, I just thought, oh, it must not be a big deal. But we could have tracked the diagnosis down a year earlier, and probably maybe there wouldn't have been 10 lesions. Maybe there would have been 8. Maybe there would have been 6. So my advice is, if you've got something wrong and you have means to get it looked at least, you should. And I know that that's kind of a blanket overall, oh, it's not very good, but that's...
No, I think absolutely.
that's what my takeaway was, other than look at life better, because that was the second thing, is now you've got this thing looming over you and you have to look at the world in a different way.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing, Kevin. I've seen you in a totally different light and so much more respect for you. And like, you're an awesome member of the community anyway. But yeah, like I say, to be able to put a story and a face to the person in the community. And also I feel like we should, you know, I don't want them stealing your thunder. I feel like we should also give a shout out to Lauren at this point, because you two have been such a great addition and she's super active. And I'm guessing she had something to do with you joining us tonight. I know she reached out to me in the first instance. So thank you to Lauren. Guys, you're awesome. And yeah, thank you, Kevin, for joining us. I really do appreciate it. On behalf of everyone, there's loads of lovely comments in chat. I'm sure you'll stick around to see them. But thank you for
joining. Have a good one, all.
Appreciate it.